This is the Wealthability Show with Tom Wheelwright. Way more money, way less taxes.
So we are definitely in the age of disruption. Everything in business is being disrupted right now. And how do we stay with it? The reality is that a lot of what we learned as business owners, entrepreneurs 20 years ago is no longer even relevant to today. And sometimes it seems like, wow, if I keep doing what I've been doing, pretty soon I'm going to be out of business. And this leads us to our discussion today, which really is how to discover when being safe is actually risky and when we need to actually completely shift our paradigm so that we can actually deal with the digital age. And we have an expert in this today, Steve Dennis, who wrote the book Leaders Leap, Transforming Your Company at the Speed of Disruption. And Steve, it is a pleasure having you on the Wealthability Show.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So if you would, I know you've written, this is your second book on a similar topic. So why, what got you into this? What's your background to say, well, it's great. I'm going to focus on disruption.
Sure. Well, I've done a lot of things across my, it's been about 40 years in the business world. I've spent most of my career in retail. Did a few other things earlier in my life, worked for a big consulting firm, worked in the consumer packaged goods world for a little while. But in the early 90s, I joined a little company called Sears. At the time, it's quite a big company. Now it's pretty much a non-existent company, which maybe we'll get to a little bit in this conversation. But spent most of my time working my way up through leadership roles, first at Sears, then at the Neiman Marcus Group. And then for the last 15 years or so, I've been doing strategy consulting. I'm on several boards. I've started doing quite a lot of speaking and have a podcast. About 4 years ago now, I guess, I wrote my first book, which is called Remarkable Retail, which really dealt specifically with what retailers need to do to stay relevant. This new book, I talk a lot about retail in it, but it's very much not just a retail book. It's really a leadership book. But I would say I've been fascinated for a long time, initially with how do you accelerate growth? But as we've been in this era of disruption now for really 20 plus years, I also started to notice, including some companies that I worked for or with, that many companies do have a hard time making the changes they need to do to stay relevant, and in some cases to stay in business, because in the case of Sears, you know, they basically don't exist anymore. And there's lots of examples of companies that were once dominant, iconic, that are now gone or struggling or mere shells of themselves.
So I think it's totally appropriate, Steve, that we have two baby boomers talking about the topic of becoming irrelevant.
Too soon, Tom.
We do not, you know, my grandkids, it's just who they are, right? Mm-hmm. Their brains are wired for it. My kids, they're just like all over it, you know, and I'm mm-hmm. looking at going, okay, my brain's not working quite that way. So I want to go right to the heart of this. What makes a company like Sears? Let's go to that story since you focus on that.
Sure.
A company like Sears, a really strong company that really, they were in their time, were innovators in the retail field. Mm-hmm.
Very much so, yeah.
What makes them into dinosaurs? What turns them into dinosaurs?
Well, I think there are a few things that are pretty common. And part of what I try to do in the book is actually deal with kind of two sides of this challenge. One is what I'd call, for lack of a better term, mistakes of strategy, where you just really don't understand fundamentally what's going on in your business. And so you're missing trends, whether that's technology or consumers, competition, what have you. And there's definitely aspects of that in most companies I look at. But the other part of what I try to get into in this book and what I've been interested in for a long time is really more the personal leadership characteristics. You know, as a leader or as a business owner, if the world has changed so much, why have you changed so little? You know, what is it? Even if you see these changes, because I think very few people listening probably aren't generally aware of how, you know, e-commerce changes things, et cetera. Like, you can go through all, you don't have to be a great student of business to notice, oh, you know, Uber is a really different way to get around. Airbnb is a really different way to travel, right? So there's lots of examples that we're all familiar with. But I think part of the question, and it was very much true at Sears, is it wasn't so much that we didn't know what we should do, or we didn't realize we were in significant trouble for a really extended period of time. It's just that we didn't do it. And I think in some cases that gets back to some of the things I delve into in the book, which is how fear keeps us stuck, how our ego gets in the way, how we're maybe not willing to dig deep and do, you know, take ourselves into uncomfortable areas to actually unlearn things, to be able to learn new things. So it's very much this mix of understanding strategically what's going on, but also looking at ourselves, taking a hard look in the mirror and saying, you know, where are we our own worst enemies in some cases?
So for those of you who don't know what Sears was, we do have listeners that they'll go, Sears?
I know.
Sears who? So Sears, obviously, you know, I equate Sears to Craftsman Tools. That's right. Actually what I equate Sears to. It was one of their great products. What do you think made Sears great in the first place? What was their strength in their heyday? What was their strength?
Well, I think there were a couple things that Sears did really well. Number one, they really understood, and this is going back, you know, 50s, 60s, kind of post-World War II boom of the move to suburbia. And along with the move to suburbia was the move to big malls, big new malls. You know, when we think about maybe the way we think about Amazon today, well, you know, regional malls were the everything store, the everything place. It was actually, my kids sometimes say they have a hard time understanding when I say, well, malls used to be convenient. And they say, what's convenient about a mall? And I'm like, well, first of all, you didn't have all this other kind of retail. You didn't have the internet. So if you wanted to see a bunch of stuff all in one place, you go to the mall where there's the Sears, the JCPenney, and then, you know, 200 specialty stores and a food court, right? There were places to go. So Sears really understood how population was changing. They were already quite well known by virtue of the mail order catalog that they had. So they're already kind of known as being the place for a little bit of everything. And so they were very savvy about that. The other thing, to your point about Craftsman, Sears really pioneered on this notion of what we often call private brands in the business. So brands that were unique to a given retailer. So folks probably now can think about Kirkland at Costco. You know, that's probably the most powerful private brand. But Sears with Craftsman and Kenmore and Weatherbeater and a bunch of other brands, they had these very powerful brands that were known nationally, but you could only get them at Sears. So that gave the customer a reason to shop at Sears versus JCPenney versus Montgomery Ward or some of the other retailers.
That's an interesting distinction with Kirkland, because Kirkland tends to just have, I mean, like you get a Kirkland golf ball, for example, it's a Titleist.
Yeah.
Right? And everybody knows it's a Titleist. And actually, it's the Titleist brand that gives the Kirkland ball, you know, it's just a lower cost, right? So you're going, I'm getting the same ball at a lower cost. Whereas with the Craftsman, That was the brand. So it wasn't like they took somebody else's manufacturing and said, well, we're going to make this our brand. They actually created that brand.
There was a lot of design and it was viewed as either a lot more, I mean, somewhat similar to Kirkland, that you get a lot more at a lower cost, or, you know, you get more features at a similar price than you might get from buying GE or Whirlpool or whatever it might be, or, you know, DeWalt.
So what happened? So where did they lose their way? What did they miss in this transition? Either out of the mall. I mean, they're still, you know, the mall's still thriving. Okay. Some malls are still thriving. Some stores and malls are still thriving, but there's no Sears. There's no JCPenney's. Okay. Right. Macy's is a ghost town. What is it that these stores have not done that, some stores who are thriving did do?
Well, I would say a couple of things. There are a few things that are particular to Sears, and I won't go too into the weeds on that. And then there's some things that are probably bigger lessons. The main thing that happened to Sears, and I think we see this with lots of different brands, is there was kind of a better mousetrap. You know, when And sometimes people say, well, Amazon was the thing that caused Sears problems. And that's very much not the case, because Sears was actually a leader in e-commerce, and Sears issues developed way before Amazon had any significant position in their product categories. But what started to happen, and this is just interesting in terms of the phases of innovation, the big growth areas in the 80s and 90s were the so-called category killers. So in Sears' case, that was competition from Home Depot and Lowe's. That was competition from Best Buy. So suddenly there, or not suddenly, but over a period of time, there were these new models which weren't mall-based, that were more convenient in that they were closer to the customer generally. They were easier to get in and out of. And then in some cases, they just sold more stuff. So, you know, that when you were Sears, you weren't really competing with that many people when it came, you know, competing with a little local hardware store or something, or the local Maytag dealer, right? But in the 80s and 90s, you had thousands of these stores that opened that were closer to the customer, in some cases had lower prices, though that wasn't as much of the issue, and then met the needs in a fundamental different way. So I think the lesson for a lot of people is, you know, because there's always disruption. It's just, it happens faster and faster now all the time, but there's always somebody coming along who's going to do a better version of what you do, or take, you know, a quarter of your business and go after it in a very specific way. So one is paying attention to that and really understanding what's happening and realize what it is you need to do to counteract that. In Sears' case, we spent way too much time trying to stay wed to our format in the mall. And, you know, the problem largely was a distribution problem. Our products like Craftsman and Kenmore weren't being sold where more and more customers wanted to buy them. And so I think one of the lessons that we see played out in a lot of cases is the protection of your core business, that you're afraid to compete with yourself, that you hold on too tight to what's made you successful forever. And that actually ends up being the worst thing you can possibly do, because you're doubling down on a losing hand, so to speak, and you're not actually addressing the fundamental problems that are causing you.
Well, some of this reminds me of one of my favorite marketing books, Blue Ocean Strategy, where Sears, when they were at their heyday, they were in a blue ocean, right? They didn't have a lot of competitors with the quality that they had, the variety that they had, and then and they were one of the pioneers of online retailing. I mean, they're a pioneer. Right. Retailing. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of, like you say, they lost that edge, because you had all these other people coming in. They had lower prices. It was more convenient. They had better software. You know, Amazon was just better software. I mean, basically, in delivery. Plus, they had a delivery aspect, which Sears didn't have. Sears always had to pick it up, right? And so there were just these little things. So how do you go about identifying that? How do you identify where your weaknesses may be, or and see it coming to make sure that you're not left behind?
Well, so one of the chapters I have is called Wake Up. And some of this is what is probably a very obvious point is, you just have to pay attention, and you have to be willing to go in some cases to uncomfortable areas to really study what's going on and gather the facts and really just become aware. But oftentimes, plenty of companies do that, but they don't really accept. And I think this is sometimes a problem with ego, where we close ourselves off to possibilities, or we're just so used to doing what we've always done that it's hard for us to do it. Just it's kind of human nature, I think, to a certain degree. But to really accept, because I can tell you, in Sears' case, but I've seen this with clients and other places I've worked, you know, we had plenty of data. We were analyzing things all the time. We had lots of consumer research. It's very hard to say that we didn't have the information needed to take action, but we didn't accept that we were very slowly going out of business. And, you know, one of the things you mentioned in the opening is this idea of that I talk about, which is not original to me, which is that safe can be risky. And in Sears' case, the way we thought about it is, well, it's really risky for us to start investing in different sort of formats off the mall and risk cannibalizing, as people like to say in retail, our existing business. But actually, the fact that we didn't do it was the riskiest choice of all. We almost guaranteed our extinction by our unwillingness to do it. But the way we looked at it because we couldn't accept the reality and the pain of our inaction, really, until it became too late. And you see this all the time. I mean, Sears is now, you know, kind of a, almost at this point, a 15 or 20 year old story, but it's no different. Bed Bath & Beyond, you know, which is a huge retailer, super successful for many years, is basically gone in the last year or so. Pier One, you know, Blockbuster's a little bit older, but, you know, you can see time and time again. I can tell you in Blockbuster, you know, they just didn't accept the reality of there was a much more powerful model in the case of Netflix originally with DVDs and then, of course, ultimately streaming. So you really have to do the homework, but you also have to sometimes think about your business in a different way. You know, at Sears, we thought ourselves of being in the tool and appliance business. It was hard for us to think ourselves as being in the project business. And the reason why one of the reasons why Home Depot and Lowe's are so successful is they're in the project business. You know, if you need to fix your toilet's broken or something like that, and you need a screwdriver or a drill or something, like, we have the tools to do that. But if you're trying to get the job done, you also may need some bolts, you may need, you know, caulk, you know, whatever. And we didn't sell any of that stuff. So sometimes, particularly in this world where there's so much choice, whether it's online or in store, so much information, you have to ultimately think about what's the ultimate outcome the customer wants to get. And are we providing the biggest solution? Sears tended to be so product focused that it was hard for us to really accept that it was the solution guys that were going to win. And once you started driving the solutions project business there, then it was really easy for you to sell lots of other products.
So one of the things that is pretty obvious right now is that you have these young influencers. I was on a podcast the other day. I swear this kid was like 12, but he was probably 20. He was probably 20, but he probably wasn't more than 20. And he was an extremely successful podcaster. So you see people rise really fast, but I think you also see that means that you can fall really fast. And so what kind of tools do you see for identifying, because it can catch you unawares. I mean, Sears, it took a long time. Okay. Sears, shame on Sears for, you know, you go, wait a minute, how'd it take you 20 years to figure this out? But these days you don't have 20 months to figure it out.
Right.
You may not even have 20 weeks to figure it out.
Right.
So what tools are there available to actually be able to track this and maybe that you could put into your company?
Sure. So just before I get to that, I mean, one of the reasons why the subtitle of the book is Transforming at the Speed of Disruption is this idea that you have to really, and it varies by industry for sure. Like, it's really hard to make one global statement about how fast one needs to move. But there's no question that the pace of disruption, generally speaking, is accelerating. And so if you aren't prepared, you don't have the agility to keep pace with it, you're very likely to get yourself into trouble. So I think part of what you have to do is just be a really good student and try to stay on top of consumer, competitive technology trends as best you can. I think a second key is try, and you know, this is easier said than done, but I think it's, how do you build more agility into your operating model? Because certainly businesses that are, and you know, you can't get completely away from this, but certainly businesses that are overly built on physical assets, you know, a hotel, a restaurant, a retail store, it's just it's a lot harder to move, right? And if you are opening new stores or a new hotel or whatever it might be, it takes you 2-3 years maybe to go from the day you decide to do it to permitting and all that kind of stuff. So that's, you know, there are some inherent liabilities to that. But the more you can build agility in, I think you're better served. And I think the other thing is what I call a culture of experimentation. It's really hard to figure out. Like, I've worked on things over the years. Some of your listeners may remember Second Life was a thing for a hot minute. Clubhouse was a thing for a hot minute. You know, MySpace, like, you know, things come. And Quibi, like, you know, there's a number of things that for a few months or a year or two were the next big thing, right? Until they weren't. So you can't pile into most cases. You shouldn't pile into some of these ideas. So how do you get enough intelligence? How do you build through the people you hire and the advisors you have a level of discernment to try to separate the BS, frankly, from the, or flash in the pan or bright shiny object, whatever you want to call it, from what maybe has enduring strength. But a lot of times you can't tell. So I think the way you respond to that is you do more testing and learning and more experimentation. You learn a little bit and then you see where things are going, whether it's working for you or not. Like I say, build in agility so you can be much more responsive. Because it is just, the world's more volatile and uncertain, and it is just harder to operate. So I think you just have to accept that's kind of the way the world is likely to be. Well, who knows? I mean, I'm past trying to predict what's going to happen anymore. But I would say generally, there are reasons to believe that it's going to be a more volatile, dynamic world in a lot of respects. So that's just a different way. And that's pretty different for a lot of companies. You know, one quick example of that, particularly all my time in retail, we built over three decades probably, a supply chain that was very much focused on just-in-time inventory. You know, right. In other words, you know, stuff doesn't show up as you try to get it as close to the time that you need it. Well, when COVID happened, that was the worst possible supply chain, right? So I don't think the answer is to go completely, all the way in the other direction. You've got to strike the right balance. But, now that we know the costs, potentially, I mean, hopefully we won't have a global pandemic again, and you can't build, all these layers of safety on the off chance that something horrible happens, right? But I think we're...
TSA thinks you can.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's one of the hard things I think about risk is, on the one hand, you could say, oh, I wasn't well prepared for certain kinds of risks, so now I'm going to be super, super safe. But then you're out of business because you spend too much money trying to be super, super safe. So, I mean, there's a volatility and uncontrollability in the world that we just have to realize, you can't completely manage all of that as much as we're taught to do that.
So you mentioned that the book is really about leadership. And so, mm-hmm. And you talk a lot about mindset. So how do you see a mindset has to be different now than it had to be even 10 years ago?
Well, I'll point to a few things. Because I've got 7 chapters that unpack that in a lot of detail. But one is, and I'm sure it's interesting as a few people have read, the book's not quite out yet, but as people have read it, in some cases, people think that one of it is I'm trying to make some sort of spiritual point or what have you. And I guess in a way I am, but not from a specific way of thinking. But I think, a lot of us that are older have been brought up in management systems where as the leader, you're supposed to have all the answers and that being vulnerable is a weakness and that you're not supposed to ask for help. That's a sign of, I'm in control. I alone can fix it, da, 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 da. And I think that's almost always a very flawed management style for a whole bunch of reasons. I think there's, plenty of people who've made themselves miserable or made others miserable by adopting that mindset. But I also think that because the world is moving so fast, because new things come up, you have to be willing as a leader to not let your ego get in the way and be willing to ask for help when you need it, be more vulnerable, say, I don't understand this, not try to fake your way through it. And I don't want to make that all about, age or gender or whatever, but I think, the style of, the way many of us were taught to lead 80s, 90s, whatever, that, was more of a military kind of way of thinking as opposed to, I think, what for most organizations is going to be better. I think one of the other things I would point to, and there's a woman named Mindy Grossman who ran a home shopping network for a while and Weight Watchers. And I heard her speak a bunch of years ago where she said, and I'm going to get this a little bit wrong, but she said something like, today we're only as good in comparison to our customer's last great experience. And what she meant by that was, she said, it used to be that, you go into a restaurant or you go to a hotel or whatever, and you have kind of this narrow view of what a great customer experience looks like in that situation. But the example she used was, well, if I go and I'm used to using the Amazon checkout process, and that's a great experience for me, then wherever I go, I start to go like, well, why can't it be good as Amazon? Or the one I've started to use lately is if I can get on my mobile device and check in for my hotel room before my plane even takes off and use my phone as a key and, I don't have to show my credit card, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. why do I have to go through this hassle at my doctor's office of, you know, filling out paperwork and signing in and swiping my card and all that kind of stuff? And part of the reason why I'm attuned to that, I mean, I think a lot of people are probably annoyed with just, you know, the state of healthcare or whatever, but, you know, it's become more obvious to me because the more I'm using mobile devices to do other stuff, like order at Starbucks, the more I look at something else and go, now I'm annoyed. And the point of that is, and I worked with a client a few years ago, whereas they were working on their strategy, they just didn't look at what was going on in their direct competition or even slightly adjacent. They looked very, very broadly in terms of what they define as consumer experience. So they were looking at hospitality and restaurants and little bakeries in Paris and, you know, night speakeasies and things like that, because in many cases, the most interesting innovation is happening at the edges. And it may be happening in, you know, your town or your direct competition. But, you know, I think the thing that's likely to be an opportunity for a lot of companies, but also maybe the thing that's going to disrupt you, may not come from your direct competition. It may come out of left field, which is the example we've seen with, you know, how the taxi industry has been disrupted or how the credit card business has been disrupted, et cetera.
I have another question for you. Specialized versus big and broad. You know, you talk about, for example, you mentioned Best Buy and the disruption with Sears, right? Well, they were much more specialized, right? They just did electronics. Right. That was it. As opposed to Sears, they did electronics and they had clothing and they had, you know, I mean, basically get just about anything at Sears. And that seemed to hurt Sears. Do you see that being a big plus for a company, or do you see that there's some weaknesses and maybe some dangers to that specialization?
I would say in general, we're at what I call peak massification. And what I mean by that is, it used to be for a long, long time that selling a little bit of everything to almost everybody was a pretty successful strategy. You know, that's what made Walmart, Sears, others really successful. I think the hard thing now is, and what I say in the book is, you know, trying to be a little bit of everything for everybody is often being nothing for anybody. And so I think what's happened now is it's a pretty short list of companies that own really big and broad, you know, Walmart, Amazon, you know, Wayfair, maybe in home furnishings, Costco. But, you know, those businesses, well, first of all, by virtue of the internet, the idea of having a lot of stuff all in one place isn't nearly as powerful as an idea as it used to be. So that's why malls are being challenged. That's why the Sears and Penney's, et cetera, are being challenged. But some of it also is what I call the collapse of the middle, which is the world is kind of bifurcating in terms of concepts, whether we're talking about hotels or airlines or retail, that are very value and convenience oriented or more premium, you know, something special from a service, experience, Salesforce, what product, what have you. If you're just selling kind of average stuff for average people, it's just too easy to lose to the price guys. Right. So you see, just to use a retail example, a lot of what's hurt Macy's has been the shift to these off-price retailers like TJ Maxx. So it's kind of the same stuff for cheaper, and it's much more convenient because there's five TJ Maxxes for every Macy's. So where does Macy's go? Or if you want something really different, you want some sales help, or you want to be just in a cool environment, you know, it's much better to go higher end or to a specialty store than be in this huge store, which has got a little bit of everything, and it's hard to find somebody to take your money or wait on you, right? So I think this middle ground is really contracting a lot. And if you're going to play on the value and convenience side, that generally means low cost position, massive scale, really being able to invest in being on the leading edge of supply chain and all this technology. And there's just very few companies that are going to out Amazon, out Walmart. So for most people, if the temptation is to try to chase those guys, I would say, you know, you're almost certainly better, to your point, by going more narrow, you know, narrowing your customer focus, going deeper, finding a powerful reason to be more relevant than the mass guys, more differentiated, and then hopefully you can charge a premium price, which helps pay for the extra service, the nicer environment, you know, whatever that might be.
Why don't we finish up with, could you give us two or three steps that you would suggest to really shift this mindset, to really be focused on being able to handle that disruption that an average business owner can start with?
Sure. So one of the things I talk about in the book a little bit is this idea of aiming higher, moving faster, and acting more boldly. And I think actually the most important one for most business owners and companies, organizations is when I say aim higher, that's based on the premise that hopefully is not too controversial, but a lot of companies miss it all the time, is that a slightly better version of mediocre is not going to win. It, you know, used to be when, and I'll just use the retail example, you know, back in the 90s when the internet didn't exist, well, everything we bought pretty much except for some mail order catalog meant we went to, you know, the stores in our neighborhood or as far as we were willing to drive. You know, our competition was the guy across the street, down the street, at the mall, whatever. It was a really constrained world. The customers didn't have access to product information really, or pricing or any of that kind of stuff. Now we're in this world where almost everything's available 24/7. You can get stuff from around the world. So you're in competition with the universe. And so if all you're doing is providing something serviceable or slightly better than average, you're not likely to get noticed, particularly, you know, we haven't talked about social media so much, but just in this world of information overload and distracted consumers, it's hard enough to get attention in the first place. Then it's, you know, even if you get attention, you know, getting customers engaged, winning their business without discounting like a maniac, that's really hard. So you've got to be more remarkable. You've got to really create something really relevant and differentiated. So the aim higher idea is distance yourself, you know, meet customers in a really remarkable way, distance yourself from the competition and really ask yourself, are you just tweaking, you know, the kind of faster horse kind of thing, or are you really doing something with great customer value? And then the other question is, even if you're doing that, are you moving fast enough? And, you know, that's going to be different for everybody. But what I see, I'll just use another quick retail example. Target, I don't know if folks have paid any attention to this, but I spend my days doing this, but Target just announced a new membership program and where you pay and you get some benefits. And it's got a lot of press, but people will know Amazon Prime has been around for a long, long time. Walmart Plus is a couple of years old, has, I don't know, 40, 50 million members. And part of the question is, okay, now as Target, have you done anything other than play catch up? So it might be worth doing, because it, you know, you're neutralizing a competitive disadvantage. But what I see a lot of times is people think, oh, look at this great innovation. And I'm like, that's just the same as everybody's, more or less. And you did it a year or two later. And that's just not likely to cause you to win a lot of business, or at least keep the business that you gain.
I love it. I love it. So again, the book is Leaders Leap, Transforming Your Company at the Speed of Disruption. Steve, where would we find more information about you and what you're doing?
Well, I'm pretty active on social media, particularly LinkedIn and X and Instagram and places like that. But of course, I have a website, which is Stephen P, as in Peter, Dennis, DENNIS.com.
Awesome. So this is such an important topic. I hope you will listen and watch this again and again, and get Steve's book, because if not, I think that it's just, I think we're going to see more people that have been around a long time go out of business really quickly. And that speed of disruption, that is such an important context. And I'll finish with a little story. I was speaking to a client of mine yesterday who's in the drug and alcohol rehab business. And one of the other people on the call said, what makes you so successful? He says, well, we're so much better. And this goes to your point about you can't be a little better. We're so much better than everybody else that we have over 100 people who've been through our program who have tattooed our logo on their body. Mm-hmm. I'm going, that is a testimonial. That is a testimonial. They've tattooed your logo on their body. That's how important what you did for them was for them. And I think this is a great lesson that you bring to us, Steve, that as we, you know, if we look at distancing ourselves from a quality standpoint, than what we're going to end up with. That's how we're going to end up with way more money. And in the end, way less debt. Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to The Wealth Ability Show with Tom Wheelwright. Way more money, way less taxes. To learn more, go to wealthability.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.